This show was brought to you by MKB Bank, SAS, and EY's Forensic and Integrity Services team. Hello everyone, welcome to the Defense Lines, Hungary's first podcast on the control functions in banking, insurance and corporate sectors. My name is András Bácsfalvi and I'm your host for the show that brings you real value and hands-on takeaways from the field of compliance, anti-money laundering, IT security, fraud prevention, risk management and internal audit. In order to achieve these ambitious goals, I'm gonna be joined by my colleagues who are not just the best in what they do, but they also have inspiring personalities that helps them through their journey of their professional lives. My today's guest is Jeffrey Robinson. Jeffrey is the best-selling author of more than 30 books and perhaps best known for writing about money laundering, fraud and other financial crimes. Born in New York, it was 1992 when he wrote The Laundryman, his money laundering tour de force. A headline maker in 14 countries, it established him as a recognized expert on organized crime, fraud and money laundering. He followed that with The Merger, documenting the conglomeration of transnational organized criminal groups. More recently, he published The Takedown, the amazing true story of a suburban mom and a coal miner's son, over the course of 15 years, destroyed Colombia's brutal Norte del Valle cocaine cartel. Actively maintaining that reputation through books, television programs and speaking engagements, the British Bankers Association has labeled him the world's most important financial crime author. You can connect with him on LinkedIn by searching for Jeffrey Robinson, Laundryman. Hello Jeffrey, welcome to the Defense Lines. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
It's my pleasure, absolutely.
In 1995, you wrote the widely known book The Laundryman, in which the true extent of global money laundering was uncovered. The book reveals how hundreds of billions of dirty dollars are derived mainly from the drug trade, then reinvested throughout the world by otherwise legitimate businessmen, lawyers, accountants, and bankers. What was your reason for taking a deep dive into this topic?
Well, money laundering was kind of a new thing in 1995. The Money Laundering Control Act only happened in 1986, and most people had never heard of it. And by the time I heard of it, it was 1992, 93, and somebody told me a story about Pablo Escobar having so much money in the United States, drug money, that he couldn't get it all into his laundering cycle, into his laundering machine. He couldn't get it, move it from where, in this case, where he was storing it in a basement in California, back to Medellin, Colombia. And because there was so much sitting in this basement and he couldn't get it out of there fast enough, it got damp and it rotted. And he lost, I don't know, $50 or $60 million in pieces of paper that just rotted, turned into nothing. And I thought to myself, that's a great story. Oh, I like this. And I'm a professional storyteller. So I started looking into other stories. And there were just so many great money laundering stories. I figured this has to be a book. And that was the birth of The Laundryman. Now, I have to say that in 1994, 95, when I was first writing about this stuff, it was all drug money. Today, it's not. The thing has shifted to the point where the overwhelming majority of dirty money circling the globe looking to get clean comes from political and corporate corruption. Drug money is number two, but corruption has just gone geometric around the world. And because there are ways of laundering that money, it has fed into this machine of political and corporate corruption. It's a horrible situation because this dirty money gets reinvested in crime. And that's the simple end of it. If you stop it, you reduce crime. If you don't stop it, crime increases.
3 years later, in 1998, you published the sequel to The Laundryman titled The Merger, How Organized Crime is Taking Over the World. In this book, you describe the disturbing lengths that transnational organized criminals go in order to build multinational corporations. You explained why organized crime is the major beneficiary of globalization, and you claimed that transnational organized criminals have become the most powerful special interest group on the planet. At that time, the significance of anti-money laundering was nothing compared to the present-day situation. I always say that fortune-telling is one of the many skills a good AML officer should have. How come you foresaw the future? Did you feel that the fight against financial crime would become one of the hottest topics in the 21st century?
No, I didn't know how hot a topic it would be. What I did know was that from 86 and the Money Laundering Control Act, and then the various derivatives of it around the world, that the gangs were starting to understand, the Medellin cartel, the Cali cartel, the Mexican groups, they were starting to understand that they needed to get clever when it came to money laundering because the good guys were now looking at it. So they devised new ways. And it dawned on me that in devising these new ways, in staying one step ahead of the good guys, the bad guys were accumulating this enormous wealth. And what happened around the same time was the Harvard School of Business, looking at globalization, said that the way a business has to survive in this globalized world of ours is to do joint ventures and cooperate with other businesses and internationalize. And that's what the gangs did. They had all this money. So you suddenly had the Cali group cooperating with the Sicilian mafia, because the Sicilians had heroin and the Colombians had cocaine, and they were doing exchanges. So you had this, they were responding to the Harvard School of Business the way legitimate businesses should, except they, of course, were illegitimate businesses. And they had so much money that the internationalization or the conglomeration of international organized crime was just a very obvious topic.
We can read about enormous fines and penalties because of AML breaches. The news is always about the financial institutions and in some cases about the employees of the banks. These fines are of course important, it is a proper tool in the supervisor's hand, but to serve the society's sense of justice, the criminals whose ill-gotten gains were laundered in the first place must be jailed. When will we get more information about those people? Or are they too big to fail?
No, what's happened is the good guys have gotten lazy. Flat and simple, it's laziness. To fine a bank is just lazy, mm-hmm. because it takes a lot more effort to go after the bankers and the lawyers and the accountants, the gatekeepers who are doing this money laundering. What they found is, you know what? We probably can't get the banker. We may not be able to get the lawyer. We can't get the accountant. So what we'll do is we'll levy a $50 million fine against the bank. And the bank will say, okay, we'll be better next time. Except the bank simply writes it off as the cost of doing business, and it doesn't get better next time.
Exactly.
You've got a case right now in England. The Financial Conduct Authority, which is the British regulator, has been asleep for the last 20 years. They're comatose. They're completely useless. They've decided they have to pretend like they're doing something. So they have gone after NatWest, and they have charged NatWest, the bank, for criminal money laundering. It's the first time that the FCA has actually charged anybody criminally, because they really don't know what they're doing. But then they said, we're not going to charge any of the bankers. Now, think about this. I mean, it's completely ludicrous. If the bank has committed criminal money laundering, what is the bank? It's made up of bankers.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
The employees. So if somebody, if the employees have done it in the name of the bank, why not go after the employees? Well, what that says to me is that the FCA, besides not having a clue at what it's doing, doesn't have much of a case either. Because if they had a case, they would go after the bankers, or somebody would go after the bankers, you'd think. Instead, I think what's going to happen is the FCA will make some sort of a settlement with the bank. The bank will pay the fine and the criminal charges will just disappear, because the FCA wouldn't know what to do with them if they charged the criminals with money laundering. I mean, that's what kind of a joke this has become. You had HSBC caught in the world's largest money laundering system when they were laundering drug money in the Mexican branches of HSBC. And it's a British bank housed in Britain. The Brits did nothing. They cowered. They peed in their pants under their desk for fear of taking on HSBC, which they saw as being too big to fail. The Americans said, oh, we'll take care of it. And the Brits were happy to let the Americans fine HSBC $1.9 billion.
Not bad.
That's a lot of money. And I know the guy who paid it. He was then chairman of HSBC. He was a friend of mine, and he was trying to put the bank back together again after the people before him got caught doing all this stuff. He paid the $1.9 billion. They wrote it off. The shareholders ended up paying for this, not the guys who were in senior management at the time. They retired and got their pensions. So it's the shareholders who paid for it, and nobody went to jail.
And what about the criminals? I mean...
Well, that's right. I say it's very simple. If you want to put a dent in global money laundering, you go after the gatekeepers. You go after the bankers, the lawyers, the accountants, the company formation agents, the brokers, the real estate people who are actually actually doing the money laundering. And you put them in a 6x6 prison cell for 20 years with a guy named Bruno who's got two fang tattoos on the side of his neck.
Yeah.
And that sends a real message to the guys who are on the outside and thinking about doing it. If they know they're going to jail, they're going to think twice. If they say, well, the bank will bail us out and the bank will pay for it, they don't care. Because the people who could put an end to money laundering, the gatekeepers, are the very ones who are making a living doing it.
When we talk about money laundering or any kind of financial crime, we can't neglect the fact that many corrupt politicians are involved. Politicians who are in charge, politicians who are responsible for setting the right legal framework. This causes a huge conflict of interest. How can we solve this issue?
Well, look where the politicians are. In some cases, the politicians are running the country with the bad guys. I know of instances where politicians in Eastern Europe are the cigarette smugglers. It's the politicians themselves who are working this cigarette smuggling game, creating all this money that they have to launder someplace. They can't spend it in their country because it's too obvious, so they go offshore. And then you look at the politicians in the offshore world. A lot of the jurisdictions try very hard to run a financial center legitimately. But on the fringes of that are politicians who are saying, you know what, we can make some money at this. You look at the Cayman Islands, for example, and I've been down there several times and I've spoken to people, and the bulk of the politicians in the Cayman Islands say that we earn a living as a legitimate financial center. But when America or Britain or France or anybody says, you have to clean up, they say, hey, that's not your problem, it's our problem, and we'll take care of it. Well, you know the story about the goose who lays the golden egg.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's going to kill that goose because this is how they earn a living. And they really do not want America, for example, to start nosing around. About, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, the Irish discovered that their former prime minister, Charles Haughey, had salted away millions and millions and millions of dollars, or pounds, Irish punts, in the Cayman Islands. He was corrupt, and this is where he sent his money. So the Irish decided, we're going to believe the Caymans when they say they're trying to be legitimate, and we're going to try and reclaim this money. So they petitioned, legally petitioned in court, for the Caymans to release all the information on Charles Haughey's illegal stash, the corruption money. And the Caymans, faced with a public relations problem, said, absolutely, we are going to give up all these accounts. You want the information, we will send it to you. And they did. But before they did, they took a black magic marker and completely erased or overwrote with the magic marker, blacked out all of the names of the people involved, all of the account numbers of the people involved, all of the sums and all of the dates. So they essentially provided pieces of paper with nothing but blacked out magic marker notes. You want to put an end to it, you could close up. In Britain, the Commonwealth is where you find so many of these financial centers. If the Queen actually wanted to do something, or Parliament wanted to do something, they could close up all these centers. And on certain occasions, they have. There was one of the islands that had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of banks. And the Brits said, this is all nonsense. And the British shut down all these, what's called Class B banks, because they weren't actually four walls and a roof. They were some guy sitting at a cafe. And he was the bank, and he had a piece of paper that said he was a bank. They closed up that stuff. But you know what? It moved someplace else. In other words, until you start locking people up, nothing's going to happen. And you start locking up the politicians, then you'll suddenly find that things will move in the right direction. But not until then. Simply finding people and yelling about it and pointing fingers accomplishes nothing. There's simply too much money to be made by doing the illegal thing.
When it comes to money laundering, we can't avoid talking about cryptocurrencies. What is your approach to this new money-like tool? Does the current EU or US cryptocurrency regulation go far enough?
No. No, I have been quite vocal about Bitcoin. I wrote a little book for Amazon, and it's a little ebook called Bitcon, B-I-T-C-O-N, because Bitcoin is a scam. It's nothing but a scam. It's an asset, supposedly an asset, that doesn't produce anything. It just sits there, and as speculation grows, the price grows. And it is controlled by a very small amount of people who have large stakes in it, and they pump and dump it. You had Elon Musk, about a month ago saying Tesla is going to accept Bitcoin. Now, Tesla did not accept Bitcoin. What Tesla did was they said, if you want to buy a car, you can pay in Bitcoin, but we don't take the Bitcoins. We're not putting the Bitcoins on our books because we're not going to gamble and take the risk on the currency movement. As you know, it moves quite a bit. So you go to one of the exchanges, you give them the Bitcoins, they will give us the dollars for the cars. Well, the other day, and Bitcoin rose with Musk's approval, rose to about, what was it, almost $60,000 a coin. The other day, Musk said, no, we're going to stop accepting Bitcoin. It's an environmental disaster, which it is, by the way. And that's a whole other side of it. The mining of it requires so much electricity that it's creating a terrible environmental disaster. He said, we're not accepting Bitcoin anymore. And the price dropped. I think it's down to 42 now. So it dropped 22 or 25% just on Elon Musk's word. I mean, you can't have a currency, and it's not a currency, but you can't have a currency that's based on Elon Musk. Sorry.
It doesn't have a real fundamentum.
No, there's nothing. It operates strictly with speculation. Now, you get these grifters, you get these snake oil salesmen who go on the financial programs and say, it's digital gold. It's the same thing. Well, it's not. It's not at all digital gold. Gold is a commodity. And commodities have floors and ceilings, which means that when the price of gold gets too high, mines open up, create more supply, and bring down the price. When the price gets too low, the jewelers buy it up, which creates more supply, more demand, and the price goes up. So there is a regulatory aspect of a floor and a ceiling. There is no such thing with Bitcoin. It's whatever the speculators think it is. And when the people like Musk open their mouth and it drops 22%, you can have no faith whatsoever. It's not an investment. It's a loaded roulette wheel. So I'm very down on Bitcoin. Now you've got Dogecoin, and that's supposedly mined slightly differently, and that's shot up. But again, the value is based on what? It's based on grifters and snake oil salesmen buying it up and saying, look, the price is going up. And suckers and the gullible saying, oh, it's an investment, I'll buy it and it'll go up. And then soon it will crash and they will lose their money. This is not something that the faint of heart should be playing with. It's a pump and dump scam. I have no time whatsoever for it. Now, what may happen, and the Canadians tried it, didn't go far enough, but what may happen eventually is governments may get into it. Now, if the US government did digital dollars or crypto dollars, and Hungary did crypto money, and the Brits did crypto pounds, you could solve one real problem, which is small coins. You know, you wouldn't have to mint pennies. It costs like almost 2 cents to mint a penny in America. It's ridiculous. The Canadians tried it with crypto, what they call loonies and toonies, which are $1 and $2 coins. And the idea was that if you were in a train station and wanted to buy a pack of gum, instead of reaching into your pocket for lots of change, you could simply put your smartphone on the thing and pay for it with these crypto Canadian dollars. That's probably a good idea. But when the government's involved, you can regulate it, you can control the swings of price swings, and you have a legitimately backed currency. Otherwise, this is not currency. Cryptocurrency is not a currency. It's a joke and it's a scam. And I really don't like the whole idea of a few people being able to control it and basically pump and dump it to steal money from the gullible.
I've read somewhere that 270 addresses are responsible for 55% of all cryptocurrency money laundering.
Yeah, there you go.
If we know it that well, how come the authorities don't take the necessary steps to fight against the inglorious 270?
Well, yeah, because a lot of them are serious investors with good lawyers. The real problem is probably education, telling people, look, it's a pump and dump scam, licensing of the exchanges, taxing it, which should be done. And I just did my US taxes. They were due yesterday. I did my US taxes. And there is a question. Have you traded in cryptocurrencies on the tax form? Because the Internal Revenue Service wants to know. But the real problem is down on the dark web, where cryptocurrencies are being used specifically for trade-based money laundering. Now, you cannot use a cryptocurrency for ordinary vanilla-flavored money laundering. If you have $1 million on the streets of Budapest in drug money. And you say, well, I'm a Colombian, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that $1 million, I'm going to buy crypto with it, and then just move the crypto to Colombia, and then I'll buy pesos with the crypto. All you're doing is taking the $1 million, turning to some guy with crypto in Hungary, and creating the same problem for him that you just got out of, which is, what do you do with all the street cash? So now he's got the problem with street cash. And if you're talking about $1 million worth of drugs money a week in the streets of Budapest, he's going to say, I can't handle that much. This is too much. So he's not going to take your problem. And then you're going to end up in Colombia moving the crypto back into street cash, in this case, Colombian pesos. It doesn't work. It's really bulky and there are too many costs involved. You're worried about the exchange rate. What do you do if you're a trafficker in Colombia and you take $1 million and when you pull it out the other end, you only get 600,000 because it's dropped 40%? Who are you going to kill? Who are you going to get angry at? Well, that's why they don't want to have anything to do with crypto for this kind of vanilla flavored money laundering. On the other hand, if you could leave the money down on the dark web and get down there and say, you know what? I want to buy guns. Yeah, there'll be people who sell you guns for crypto. So what has to happen is the good guys have to get down there and close up the dark web. That will put an end to it. But in the meantime, Bitcoin is the coin of the realm for trade-based money laundering on the dark web. And it's very, very difficult to stop.
As for the last question, you have written 5 books about financial crimes, but the last one was issued in 2014. When can we read your next book? And as you always foresee the future, it is also very important to us. What will be the topic you will cover?
Well, what I'm doing now is I'm going back to the original Laundryman and I'm updating it, revising it, rewriting it, and creating a new book called The New Laundryman, which I hope will be maybe next year. Depends on, the coronavirus has gotten in the way of everything, but maybe next year. The idea being, what's happened since? And the bad news is that what's happened in the last 30 years since the original book is the bad guys have won. They're winning. The good guys have gotten lazy. They're finding the banks. They're not doing what they should be doing. They're not. Federal agent told me that when he takes a money laundering case to a U.S. attorney to prosecute, more often than not, the U.S. attorney says it's too expensive to prosecute. It takes too many man hours. There are too many moving parts. I don't want it. I'm not interested because we'll put these guys away and 2 more guys will show up tomorrow. So in a lot of cases, governments are just giving up, which is what finding the banks is all about. But I've also looked at it in a broader sense, and I'm starting to script a television series, which will happen, if it happens, will be 2024, 2025, a dramatic television series based on the money laundering stories that I know of, and create a bunch of really good characters and a lot of action and a few pretty women, and try to explain that money laundering, that the drug business is a business. And like any business, like General Motors or Maloff Airways or Ford or Microsoft or Apple or Amazon, like any business, the business needs cash flow and reinvestment. And if you were to do that to any business, even the corner grocery store, if you cut off the cash flow and cut off the reinvestment, the business would go broke. Well, you can do the same to drug trafficking and you can do the same to corruption. You can cut off the cash flow and cut off the reinvestment. And that business, the business of drug trafficking or the business of political corruption or the business of corporate corruption, will stop. And that's what you have to do. You have to follow the money and you have to spend the money to follow the money and put the people who are moving it in prison with that guy named Bruno, who's got the fang tattoos on the side of his throat.
So dear colleagues, dear fellow compliance officers, reading Jeffrey Robinson's newest book is highly recommended.
Let me add one other thing, if I may.
Of course.
I'm on LinkedIn, and if anybody queries on LinkedIn, Jeffrey Robinson, Laundryman, LaundryMen, Laundryman, you'll find me on LinkedIn. Send an invitation to connect. I will connect with you immediately. And I write about this stuff often enough on LinkedIn and have some fun with it. And I'm an equal opportunity offender. I insult bankers, lawyers, accountants, governments, money launderers, prosecutors. I go after them all.
At least you're neutral.
Oh, hardly. Hardly.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. You have just listened to The Defense Lines, the podcast for the control functions. If you found value in this episode, please subscribe so you will never miss a show. András Bácsfabi is signing off, but till our next meeting, do not forget, those who try to convince you that safety can be increased only by jeopardizing your business goals will eventually deprive you of both.